So you may end up killing someone from doing a Reboa and someone that has otherwise possibly survivable injuries. So like I said, it's not a free pass.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Landers, founding publisher of the JSOM. I'd like to thank you for joining the JSOM's 20th anniversary interview series. We are excited to bring together a host of experts, all leaders in the soft medical community. In these interviews, we will be discussing the ever-evolving methods of treating battlefield trauma and injury and how those methods have changed over the 20 years since the JSOM's inception. I hope you'll find these talks as informative as we do.
All right, and we have a very special guest this month. This is a recently retired Lieutenant Colonel Ted Redman, who was the regiment surgeon for the 160th and has done just an incredible amount of work both to advance soft practice as well as provide just some incredible care to incredible folks on the ground and in the air. Welcome to the show.
All right, thanks. I'm glad to be here. Glad for the invite.
Oh, absolutely. And for those out in the audience who have not had the privilege of either working with you or learning from some of your great education out there at SOMA, maybe you could give the guests a little bit of a background about your involvement with soft medicine.
Sure. So I started out enlisted. I was a medic in the 1st Ranger Battalion from 91 to 95. Then about halfway through my enlistment, I decided I wanted to see if I could go become a doctor. So I got out. I left the Army in 95 and went to college. Then went to medical school at USU's, and then I did my residency at Madigan, and then I graduated residency, and I went back to the Ranger Battalion as a battalion surgeon from 06 to 09, and did 4 deployments to Iraq during that time. Then I was a chief of the ER at Fort Stewart for about a year and a half. Then I went to the 160th, another 4.5 years as a battalion surgeon there, and did a number of deployments to Afghanistan. Then I did an EMS fellowship at Fort Sam for 2 years, and then I came back to the 160th to be the regiment surgeon for the last 3+ years of my time in the military. And since then I retired and I'm living here in Savannah working for a private company.
Oh boy, and it's just such a privilege to chat with you because, as I'm sure you know, there is not much publicly available information about the 160th SOAR. But in looking at Wikipedia, which is always a terrible source for information, there's sure a lot of folklore and myths. So it's always a pleasure to chat with you all.
Yeah, it's a reasonable place to start, Wikipedia.
That's fair. That's how I win all my Twitter arguments. So today I think we'd love to chat with you about a really important topic within soft medicine, which is the use of pre-hospital Reboa. And I think you've had a fair amount of involvement with that. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. We looked at ways to make it feasible for use in the pre-hospital setting.
Yeah. And certainly there's continues to be a fair amount of, I'll say, discussion about that point.
Yep.
Recently listened to a lecture from Todd Rasmussen, who helped co-invent it. And he said it's more of a nuanced conversation than a lot of us are allowing it to be. But maybe you could give our audience a little bit of a background about Reboa, where it came from, and what was the impetus for its use within the military.
Sure. So like many things in medicine, everything old is new again. So Reboa initially came out during the Korean War, and it was used on a couple of casualties, and unfortunately all the casualties died. But the guy, Colonel Hughes, wrote about it and wrote his case series of like 3 people. It sort of went away after that. Then the vascular surgeons picked it up, and there's various ways of doing a Reboa. It became an over-the-wire scaffold of some type with a coated balloon catheter and the 330-centimeter, that's 9 feet long, Amplatz wire that was used. Obviously, you're supposed to put it in a sterile fashion, so it was mainly used in vascular surgeries in operating rooms for a number of years. And then some trauma surgeons decided to start using it in the hospitals, and it slowly grew from there. Then the London's Air Ambulance Service picked it up And they've had some success with it, and they broadcast their success in their training methods, and it made the lay press as, you know, being this big thing that they could do on the roadside, which is what they did. They actually didn't use the ER Reboa that most of us are familiar with. They used the old Kota balloon catheter with a 330-centimeter amplatz wire. And Scott Weingart put it out on an MCRIT podcast, and it's very interesting to listen to. So that really started getting the ball rolling in the pre-hospital setting here in the U.S. And myself and some other people got a grant and started looking at the feasibility of using it in the pre-hospital setting. So we got a grant from the Air Force, and so we purchased cadaver specimens from UT Southwestern in Dallas and went to the Center for Emergency Health Sciences in Boca Verde Spring Branch in Texas. And they're a state anatomic lab. So we initially perfected the technique. That's how we wanted to perfuse the cadaver, which was an issue because obviously just putting a catheter in the vessel of the cadavers can be kind of problematic itself. So we had to reperfuse the cadaver specimens. And then we started on a table, then we put them on the ground, then we brought them outside, then we put them in a civilian ambulance. Then finally, we were able to put in a civilian Blackhawk with the Texas Air National Guard and fly around and do Reboas in the air just to see if it was able to be done. And it was, and we published those results.
And if I remember, the London study also mentioned having a number of difficulties encountered when they were doing some of their first case series. And in particular, they had a really hard time seeing the ultrasound screen out in the direct sunlight. I imagine you guys found a number of good lessons learned when doing this in an austere environment. What were some of the insights or challenges that you were able to work through on that?
Yeah, so some of the things that we found, you need to use, for Americans, we typically use an ultrasound to find the common femoral artery. For all the Japanese, where most of the studies of Reboa come from, they just use landmarks. They're shorter, skinnier people, and we Americans are bigger and fluffier and huskier. So using the ultrasound during the day can be an issue, so you have to try to dim the lights. Trying to put in a Reboa on a moving ambulance is a fool's errand, and all paramedics know this. Whenever they're about to intubate somebody or they have to do something where they've got to get it done, they have whoever's driving pull over and stop for a minute or two. They do whatever procedures they do, usually an intubation of some type, then they start driving again. And we found that's what actually was far more helpful than trying to cannulate a femoral artery while the ambulance is driving down the road. It was actually somewhat easier to cannulate a femoral artery in a helicopter because you're just vibrating in sync with the helicopter. And it was easier partially due to training because we had done a number of Reboas in the cadavers by then, but also it was just simpler.
What's a groundbreaking set of standards to establish? And in thinking about some of these different topics have changed within the last 20 years, I like to always ask the question of where was the gap where this intervention was needed? Did you identify that there were any patient care gaps that could be met with the use of Reboa in a pre-hospital soft environment?
Yes. So I have a personal gap analysis of people that I worked on in combat that could have been helped with a Reboa, because as I was working on them, in my mind, I'm an emergency medicine physician, I thought, go to thoracotomy. But the situation just wasn't right for it. I had a scalpel and I could really try and get in there, but that would be pretty difficult without a rib spreader. Thinking back, if I had a Reboa catheter, and if the tactile situation was permitting, I'd probably put in a Reboa catheter. So there's at least three casualties that I can think of, three American or coalition casualties that I probably could have put in a Reboa catheter on, and perhaps that would have changed the outcome. As you know, Johnny Morrison did a gap analysis using casualties of Camp Bastion, and he said about maybe 20% of the wounded that came into Camp Bastion could have been potentially helped by a Reboa catheter.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to go read that article. I'm not familiar with it. We've seen a pretty dramatic evolution of Reboa practice since the first CPG came out, and now we see such differences in practice with the use of the ER Reboa as early arterial access and not requiring a wire to use it. These are a lot of really dramatic changes since we first started doing that. Do I remember that your enterprise was the first to really start some of these practices?
I think that's correct. I remember talking with Frank Butler and others at one of the COTSI meetings, and because we talked about advanced resuscitative care, which is basically using whole blood and Reboa or some type of aortic occlusion. I remember telling people that, when I deployed in October of 2017, we were fully prepared to do Reboa in flight. So at that point, we established that capability, and it was myself and a couple other people that I had trained that were able to do that, were able to work as a team on the back of MH-47 that had that capability. We didn't need to use it at that time, but I know on at least one casualty, we certainly discussed it, but we ended up not doing it. But yeah, that was roughly when we were able to field that capability. There are some other surgical units and some Air Force Special Operations surgical teams that were doing it roughly around that time on the ground, mainly in Syria, as they were moving up with the SDF as in the fight against ISIS.
Yeah, and for more on that, I'd certainly refer folks over to some of the other published JSOM articles, which are publicly available and approved information on that, because there are some just incredible case studies. Those guys were doing great things. And maybe you could walk us through the stepwise method for using Reboa in the pre-hospital environment. What are the different steps that you teach your medics and providers there on the back of the helicopter?
So the indications for Reboa are wounds, between the symphysis pubis and below the nipple line. Obviously, if they got holes in the chest, and if you think there's a vascular injury above the nipple line, that's a contraindication to Reboa. Because obviously, if you put the balloon up in zone one, and it'll just make blood squirt out of any holes, proximal to that balloon. So you have to look at your patient and determine that they're an appropriate candidate, and then start your treatment by resuscitating them with whole blood. So they have to be a non-responder to whole blood in order to become a possible candidate for Reboa. So you start your whole blood resuscitation, you've stopped all the other external bleeding that you can stop, you've done all your procedures, and at the time that you're giving the whole blood, you need to start considering getting femoral artery access. And the way we teach it is to gain it with the 5-French finder needle that I know as a resident physician I was taught to ignore, because you need to get the bigger steel bore finder needle and trying to access the central vessel like when you're doing an internal jugular central line. But what we've found is that paramedics and all military medics know how to start an IV catheter. And really, by using that 5-French finder needle that's included in all the central line kits, you can just access the femoral artery through that. And they actually are very good at that. I was kind of surprised when we found that out just doing some training, that they could all use that pretty well in conjunction with an ultrasound, rather than trying to use the syringe and needle and stab with it that ways. So there's a whole lot of micro skills that they just hadn't refined yet, but they had those micro skills to start an IV. So it was actually a lot easier to do it in that fashion, just to gain access to the femoral artery. Then, once you get the flash and there's blood spurting out the back end, you just slide the plastic catheter forward, cap it, flush it, and put a tegaderm over it, and you can hold what you've got there. And so now you have femoral artery access. And if the patient doesn't respond to their whole blood treatment, then you can consider putting in a Reboa at that point.
Oh, what a great point. And in chatting with you previously, I remember you talking about some of the exclusion criteria for even considering Reboa was time to the next level of care.
Yep.
How do you consider that?
That comes into play before you even leave on the mission. I mean, because you know where your objective area is, you're going to do your time distance analysis. And hey, if we have a casualty who's actually dying on us, but we are an hour and 30 minutes away from the nearest surgical facility, that person really isn't a Reboa candidate until you're 30 minutes out, because Reboa is simply a 30-minute bridge, 30 to 60 minutes, and that may change depending on partial Reboa. But right now, it's roughly 30 to 60 minutes to a definitive surgery. So if you're outside of that, then the person's, unfortunately, is not a Reboa candidate.
Yeah, which is fair, but that's certainly a rapidly evolving field with some of the intermittent and partial occlusion that some of our really outstanding LTT labs are working on. And, in going back to the CPG, I see that there's an entire section devoted to the aeromedical evacuation considerations. You would be an excellent candidate to maybe educate us on what some of those aeromedical evacuation considerations would be for a Reboa patient.
Okay. So some of the aeromedical considerations, if you're doing facility to facility, I don't know of anyone that would recommend leaving a zone one Reboa inflated and in place during facility to facility. Like the CPG says, you should probably keep the access sheath in, I would recommend taking the Reboah catheter itself out because it's thrombogenic and you're going to potentially cause some clots, which are a known complication. And then obviously the patient declines en route, give them back some whole blood or blood products in a one-to-one ratio if you have it. And then consider reinflating the sheath up in zone one. Obviously, you have to have someone on the aircraft that is familiar with inserting and inflating a zone one Reboah. And obviously, then call ahead and say, hey, you know, the patient's declining and we're going to be there in X amount of minutes. And again, you know, the time distance considerations are always there. If it's more than 30 minutes, consider not doing the Reboah. You can do an intermittent Reboah. You can inflate it, leave it fully inflated for 15 minutes, then take it down and see how the patient's doing. And if they decline again, then you can reinflate it. And you just have to continue resuscitating with blood at that point. I mean, your back is to a wall at that point. You're in the air in a helicopter. There's literally nothing else that you can do.
Yeah, I've often heard a lot of people say that we inaccurately consider when the Reboah goes up and the patient stops bleeding that we've won the war. But I think I've heard from folks that really we've still got quite a big fight on our hands and it's just a thumb in the dike at that point. Is that?
Yeah, it's a bridge.
That's fair. So that's a pretty incredible overview of where it came from and how to use it. And so maybe I'd ask you, who do you think the current audience for pre-hospital Reboah is? Should it still be reserved to special operations? Is there a role for PJs or how about conventional forces or civilian tactical practice?
Well, certainly there's a role for experienced providers. They don't necessarily have to be special operations. There's a number of PJs and a number of conventional medics that have the experience and judgment necessary and the skill necessary to put one in. And I would be comfortable teaching them. This is not something that you'd teach, you know, you'd have your basic medics or your new medics do. In the 160th, we would teach all the medics so that the new guys could assist in the more senior guys putting one in. But those new guys also knew that they were absolutely not to put it in on their own. That their job was simply to be an assistant. And we had we had some team training involved with as to whose roles were what, because you can quite often get target fixated when you're trying to access the artery initially. And so one of the jobs as assistant is to set a 5-minute time. Like, hey, if you keep going after the artery, trying to get it percutaneously with an ultrasound for 5 minutes, the assistant's job is to stop the person, tell them to go to open. Because as we know, fully about 50% of the in the trauma bay, probably about 50% of the Reboahs that get placed through an open technique. So you have to have open femoral access skills as well. And it's actually pretty simple. I mean, it's a skin incision, then it's a blunt dissection down to the femoral artery. There's nothing critical that lies between the skin and the femoral artery in anyone. So you make a big incision, blunt dissect down, and you can just stick the femoral artery with 5 French finer needle or your 7 French at that point. I recommend it's your medical officers, your PAs, physicians, and your senior medics. And some of the planning considerations we would have is to try and make sure we could have someone that was skilled in or signed off in Reboah overseas with us at all times. Now, we couldn't do that at all times just because Reboah training is fairly lengthy and it's expensive. Obviously, we're doing it on cadavers. So we weren't able to get everyone trained up in a quick fashion. So it's just something that you have to build into your training pipeline and your planning as to who's going to get trained and when, and you're going to have to budget for it because Reboah is expensive.
And then how about in terms of, you think there's a role for PJs or conventional forces or tactical EMS?
Absolutely. PJs are very smart people and they can certainly be trained to do a Reboah. On the tactical medic side, there's been a couple of EMS agencies, especially some that do SWAT calls, that have shown an interest in Reboah. It depends on that because many times for most SWAT missions, I mean, you're in a city already and you are just a few minutes away from a level one. So it just may not be tactically needed or tactically relevant in those situations.
That's a really good point. And I think if I remember from some of the previous education, what I've heard a number of folks say is the challenge with Reboa isn't really the procedure. You can teach really anybody the procedure, but determining when the procedure is indicated and for what patient is really the challenge. And it sounds like that's also what you experienced on your team as well. And in terms of personnel, you mentioned that you had both medics as well as officers. What was your policy within the 160th about who was performing the procedure, and how many people did you need on a team to make that work?
You needed at least two people on the team to make it work. And it was something that we had trained on and drilled on in the 160th. And we put cadavers on our helicopters. We would perfuse the cadavers and put them on our helicopters. We'd fly and do trauma training on them and do Reboas on them as well. The medics caught on very quickly. I mean, they're all smart people that have been specially selected and well-trained. And I was pretty impressed. The first medic that did it in flight, I'd shown him how to do it on the ground. Then we loaded up another cadaver. We took off, we're flying around, and he put a Reboa in like he had done 100 of them. He had it in within just a couple minutes from the time the needle touched his skin till the balloon was up. I was pretty impressed with how quickly he was able to get it in. And so it's fairly easy to train on, two people minimum. I think there's been a couple people that said, yeah, I need three, and one of them has to be an ER doctor, or you need a team. Well, if your team is trained and you're skilled in doing it, then you have the judgment and it's tactically feasible, I would say go for it. You know, if it was my kid that was laying there bleeding to death, yeah, I'd like you to do it. It doesn't matter if you're not an emergency physician. As long as you've been trained in how to do it, then please execute.
Yeah, fair enough. We've always got to figure out if the juice is worth the squeeze, but it's not a cerebral conversation to have on the battlefield with an injured service member. You mentioned the personnel for the procedure, and I think that's really important. If I remember, and I'd love for you to correct me, isn't there a joint position statement? Is it with the American College of Surgeons and the American College of Emergency Physicians about who they deem appropriate for placing a Reboa?
That's exactly right. One of my old attendings from residency, Chris King, wrote it, and I saw him after he wrote it, and we had an energetic discussion about it. But he did point out that there is a military carve-out on it. You know, there's fair points. As you know, this is still can be somewhat of a controversial topic. But yeah, there are times where you have nothing left to throw at the patient except some type of aortic occlusion. And in the austere environment, it can be a reasonable thing to do. And during OIF, and when during the height of the wars, I had done some thinking and some training on this, and I was like, you know what, if it's someone I know and like, I'll open the person's belly. If my back is against the wall, I can't evacuate them, and we're in a safe house somewhere else, and they're bleeding to death internally, I will open the belly and get after it.
Yeah, and in going into detail, do I remember, I think the joint position statement is that Reboa is the domain of surgeons and also, as you mentioned, emergency medicine physicians, but only if they are in the military and only with additional training. Is that right?
I think that's correct. I haven't looked at that in a couple of years, but yeah, I think that sounds reasonable.
So I'd love for you to expand more on your energetic discussion with your counterpart, because I think it is interesting, because as you mentioned, most of the Reboa data comes from Japan, and it's my understanding in Japan that is almost exclusively the domain of emergency room physicians who use it as a temporizing effect while the surgeon is coming in-house.
It is, and my understanding of the outcomes in Japan is they are not as good as we have here in the U.S., because they will put a Reboa in a patient and then put them in an ambulance and send them to the next hospital. And it may take 30, 45 minutes or more to get a patient to the next hospital. And if they've got a zone one Reboa, then that's a significant problem. It's a commonly taught emergency medicine procedure in Japan, but we just don't do that here in the United States. Our political climate, our medical legal climate is different.
And so what was your protocol in your enterprise? Were you having surgeons do this, or did you have experience with other providers who were successful with this application?
So part of what we did during my EMS fellowship, we helped bring it online in Brooke Army Medical Center. I talked with Tyson Becker and Stacey Shackford there, and I helped show it to some of the emergency department nurses and stuff so that they would be familiar with it for when we ended up using it in the trauma bays. And we used it once when I was there. But yeah, we help to get it online because there's certainly a training component to that.
Within your enterprise, who were the providers who were applying this procedure? Was it just limited to surgeons or emergency room doctors? Or I think I heard a rumor that perhaps some of your PAs were doing it as well?
Yes, within the 160th, yes, we trained our medical officers, meaning doctors and PAs, and our, like I said, our senior flight medics in how to do this. Because typically we would fly a minimum of one flight medic per every mission overseas. We would fly a resuscitation team, meaning a senior medic and a junior medic, or a medical officer and a medic on our bigger helicopters when we could, because in that fashion, we're pretty convinced we can get the best outcomes. So we've always noticed that in training and in doing trauma resuscitations in flight, having two sets of competent hands, it makes things a lot easier. When we fly two people, and if one of them was trained in Reboa, then they could offer the Reboa capability. So we would train the PAs and some of the officers as well. In the 160th, we would have family medicine and emergency medicine and the occasional aerospace medicine physician. The emergency medicine folks certainly had heard about it and were interested. Family medicine and others were interested as well. They simply hadn't seen it during their residency training.
Oh, how interesting. And so that ties very nicely into how we like to end these conversations, which is, so do you know, have you been able to quantify the patient benefit from Reboa? And I didn't think about this, but have you been able to look at outcomes between your various different providers, family medicine versus emergency medicine?
We've looked in detail at our AARs and our outcomes and our procedures that we've done, and we simply haven't done enough Reboas to look at outcomes between specialty. But overall outcomes between specialties, we haven't looked at that.
Yeah, I think this is one of those many different interventions which are the domain of the military medical provider, which is a low-frequency, high-risk procedure where it's really hard to come up with retrospective or even prospective data on it, and we're stuck with case series.
Yeah, I liken it to a crike, which, you know, in the wars, someone might end up doing one or two crikes or more crikes than they typically would over the course of their career. In fact, it's probably doing a Reboa is probably less going to be less frequent than doing a crike. But like I said, I've got a personal gap analysis of a couple of people that, man, if I could have done a Reboa, I would have, because you know, it sucks when they die right in front of you. The alternative is go to thoracotomy, which, again, I'm totally agnostic about aortic occlusion. If we end up showing that clamshell or lateral thoracotomy actually does better, then we'll transition over to that rather than a Reboa. Or if the rescue foam does better, then we'll transition that, because the overall goal is simply to save lives.
Well, and before everyone goes running out and tries to get one of these devices for their pocket, maybe we could put a little asterisk in there. And, you know, from a scientific perspective, maybe you could give us a little bit of kind of the insight for our false positive patients. So what would be the harms to applying Reboa in a patient who might end up not needing it? Is there a cost to applying Reboa?
Absolutely there is. Yeah, there's a very significant cost. Currently, the recommendations for combat casualties is to put the Reboa up in zone one. And if the patient doesn't need it, I mean, as soon as the balloon goes up, everything distal to that balloon is dying, and the person can die from that, from what may have been an otherwise survivable injury. So the judgment portion of Reboa is very significant. It can't be understated. You can cause paralysis, their intestines are going to start dying, their kidneys are going to start dying. So you may end up killing someone from doing a Reboa in someone that has otherwise possibly survivable injuries. So like I said, it's not a free pass. There's a significant amount of training, and there's a significant amount of financial cost to that training. The Reboa catheters are roughly $2,000 each. A cadaver comes, depending on where you buy it from, it's about $3,000 each. And then if you want to perfuse it, that's a little bit more. You can perfuse it yourself, which is actually fairly easy to do, and I recommend people do that. But yeah, the training for Reboa there's a very significant time cost and a significant financial cost for the unit. So you have to take that into consideration as well for something that's ultimately probably going to be somewhat of a low-frequency intervention.
Oh, so what a great segue. And so in addition to the minimum competency, how have you been able to document continuing proficiency? What's that look like for you?
So what we do, we had an Excel spreadsheet, and when people did them, I added them to my Excel spreadsheet, and I told them, yep, you've done five, and I've watched you do them. So, yeah, I'm relatively confident with you deploying this intervention into combat. And as you know, in the military, the medics and the PAs work under your license, so you're the one who's licensed on the bottom line, so I was relatively careful about who got to deploy with the kit.
Yeah, fair enough. And so was that a minimum of five passing prior to deployment, or was there an annual requirement as well, or how did you maintain the ongoing proficiency?
Both. Yeah, so we had, it was minimum five during training, and then you'd have to do two more on an annual basis during training. We'd put cadaver training into our schedule so we could get that done.
That is... does not sound inexpensive for the unit or, as you mentioned, for the patient. My last Reboa patient was actually a cardiovascular patient, and the cardiothoracic surgeon had very gently placed the Reboa into the retroperitoneal space. And whenever you poke a hole in an artery, things go really bad. And so we ended up opening that guy's abdomen and getting 20 units of blood out of his abdomen because he had just gotten ongoing resuscitation through the whole procedure because you can't stop heart surgery. And it had all gone right out that hole and right into his viscera, which was a really terrifying thing to open up. So certainly no free chicken there.
No. No, and yeah, as you mentioned, that's another complication of Reboa. The other things, you know, we know about are the distal thrombus to the sheath. That's always significant.
Yeah, and we at BAMC have seen that as well. There was a pretty public patient that we had last year who ended up having a lower extremity amputation, and it's pretty hard to tease out after the fact if the reinflation of the Reboa ended up saving his life from ongoing bleeding or if it was unnecessary and cost him his leg. And so certainly no one wants to second guess the provider on the X at the battlefield, but we do need to be reminded that these interventions are high risk and have complications. And so as we tend to wrap up here, sir, do you have any wisdom that you care to impart for perhaps that junior soft medic out there who is looking at Reboa and potentially involving it or deciding not to involve it in their practice?
So, yeah, I would have to say that most significantly is make sure you have a whole blood program, make sure you're carrying whole blood first. Then you have to look at your AOR and decide if it even fits for Reboa, because if you're in Africa and it's 3 hours to a surgical team, Reboa probably does not have a place in that environment. I mean, you could bring it with you and you could tell yourself that during the CASVAC phase, once you're 30 minutes out of the patient's still declining, then you can potentially put up a Reboa. But I think in that case, the juice is not worth the squeeze because Reboa comes at a significant time cost and financial cost simply to train on it. It's a very significant muscle movement, and you've got to be very diligent about making sure you're getting your training in.
That sounds a lot like the TC3 and PFC discussion going on now, when so many of the folks in the PFC working group say if you skip the basics of TC3 and move on to PFC, you are planning for failure. And I think what I hear from you is that if you are planning on Reboa as being your catch-all, save-all, and are not focusing on a robust resuscitation program, you may be planning for failure. Is that what I hear?
That is correct. Yeah, when I first started looking at Reboa, I've heard some people say, hey, this thing needs to be in every medic's rucksack or every 18 Delta's rucksack. It's like, no, that's a terrible idea, actually. Like I said, if you don't train on it, if you don't see patients on a regular basis, you're really going to hurt somebody by putting in a Reboa. It's a tool in the toolbox with very niche opportunities. It's not a catch-all. Just, you know, stop the bleeding from the aorta and the patient's going to live and get up and walk out of the hospital. That's absolutely not going to happen.
Wonderful. Well, Lieutenant Colonel retired Dr. Ted Redmond, thank you so much for your time and insight today. And more importantly, thank you for all of the hard work you did to ensure our injured sons and daughters on the battlefield return home to their families. Really appreciate all your time. Thank you for your help.
All right. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.